This is CliffCentral.com.
I'll tell you what we all care about. There's so much news this week to talk about. The Burning Platform. Justice Malala will be back next week. And I thought, let's get a commentator whose stuff I've been reading for years. He's a columnist, in his own words, on liberty and free markets, a prosperity monger, a knowledge dealer, a defender of the innocent, debunker of myths. And he's not for sale. But this morning he's here to give you his opinion. And I'm delighted to welcome to the show for the first time as part of the Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's this morning, Ivo Fechter. Listen, he's written countless columns. He also is a regular in the Daily Maverick, among others. And this morning we're going to talk about a bunch of things. Let me give you a quick preview so you have some idea of what's going to come up here, because there's a laundry list. It's been a very busy week. So Ramaphosa is our president. He's only been president for a little over a week. What kind of a president is he? What sort of a cabinet has he chosen? What kind of contradictions and pipe dreams are there in SONA? And what about this expropriation without compensation that they've been talking about in Parliament this week that they've already voted on? In particular, what are the consequences for agriculture, for food security, and the possibility of violence? So there's a ton of stuff to talk about with Ivo. Hi, Ivo. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, and you?
Excellent. I'm delighted to speak to you. I've been a long-time avid reader of much of the stuff that you write, and so much of it cuts through the crap, which is one of the reasons we wanted to have you on the Burning Platform this morning. It's been a busy week, Ivo. Where do you want to start?
It's actually difficult. I think the first thing that we should probably note, seeing as everybody seems to be so in love with Cyril Ramaphosa, is that we should not forget that he, or not think that he's anything other than a committed socialist.
Yeah.
No. That he thought it was okay to go and become a billionaire while, you know, millions remain mired in poverty just makes him an hypocritical socialist.
Right.
But a socialist he is.
So why would, I mean, if someone heard that for the first time and they thought maybe they were some kind of trendy millennial who thought there's nothing wrong with socialism, explain to us why that would be bad for a political leader in South Africa's context. And try not to use Venezuela. Try not to use Venezuela as an example.
Well, Venezuela is an excellent example.
Yeah.
The thing is that socialism always fails. You know, it's failed everywhere. Everywhere we've had it, everyone has tried it, and people always say, "Oh, but that wasn't real socialism. That wasn't real socialism." They keep coming up with excuses, and they keep trying it again. And every new bunch thinks that they've got the way to promote socialism, but they basically all follow the same strategy, which in South Africa we know as the National Democratic Revolution. Mm-hmm. That strategy was sort of originally written by Marx, Lenin, and Engels.
Yeah.
But then the particular version the ANC uses was written in 1962 by the South African Communist Party. You know, so they all follow the same sort of strategy. And they all say, Blaydim Mzimande recently wrote that we had always understood the National Democratic Revolution as the most direct route to socialism.
Right. And the primary issue that some people might have with this is that it results in some kind of social engineering, which is what we've come from in South Africa with apartheid, where people were segregated, they were sent to certain areas, they were made to do certain kinds of work, and they were treated as different kinds of citizens. And that's essentially what socialism wants to do, right?
Yes, and you know, that's really the problem. The government ends up deciding what you do, where you live, what you may do with your land, which you lease from the government, you know, once it's expropriated, what jobs you'll do, what jobs are available. It becomes a sort of government decides, a very paternalistic, central planning sort of state. You know, it's weird. I thought it was very evil to very easy to oppose Zuma, the evil of Zuma.
Yeah.
You know, he was obviously evil, right? And even a child can oppose Zuma. I mean, the DA did, you know, and it was very easy. The far more dangerous evil is that committed by a person who's intelligent and well-educated, who appears well-meaning, and who expresses his intentions with charm and charisma, right? And that, to me, is the difference between Jacob Zuma and Cyril Ramaphosa. And of the two, I think Ramaphosa is far more dangerous.
Now, that's interesting because most people were very relieved when Jacob Zuma resigned and that Cyril came in. And a lot of people thought, well, this is a guy who's an ally to sensible, rational policy. He wants a responsive and an effective government. I mean, it almost seems to me like we're tilting at windmills if we take it on the face of coverage that was given to him by the likes of the Mail and Guardian.
Yeah, I mean, the media was far too busy, having or being infatuated with him to actually critically look at anything that he said. The whole idea that he's going to have all these rational policies that are going to lift us out of our mire at the moment. Mm-hmm. If you just listen to his Sona speech, you'll see that there's a whole lot of contradictions there. I mean, with one hand, he promises to enact land expropriation without compensation.
Right.
Right, which would require a constitutional amendment to the property clause. With the other, once he's gutted the property clause, he says he wants to woo both domestic and foreign investors. Well, he can want whatever he likes, but what fool of an investor is going to bring their capital to South Africa if they cannot be sure that their property rights are secure?
And what kind of a fool is busy a week before he becomes president in Davos convincing everybody to invest when he knows full well that he's going to be undermining those property rights the very next week?
Yeah, no, exactly. It's he speaks from two sides of his mouth, and which is what socialists do. They make contradictory promises. They believe that they can do all sorts of cool things and have they believe they can have their cake and eat it, if you like, in economic terms.
Let's talk about some of the other specifics he addressed in the Sona and break them down so that they're understandable to all of us. Government investment funds for speculating in startups. I mean, government is not well known as being a good investor, even in things that it already supposedly understands, like Eskom and Transnet and the SABC. How could it possibly be a good speculator in terms of investing in startups?
I think it's an absolutely insane idea. I mean, startup investing is perhaps the most difficult and risky business you could possibly be in. Right? A bunch of rich people with experience in that sector sometimes do it. But there's a great chance that they lose their money. Mm-hmm. They invest slowly. They invest in tranches. Right. In the early days, quite a lot of the startups fall out. So the chances that they lose money is just insanely big. It just takes a lot of skill, dedication, and attention to detail, right, which I don't believe the government possesses. The problem is in a competitive market, right? Startup investors who fail, right, because they pick the wrong startups, mm-hmm. right, they only lose their own money.
Yeah.
Right? And then only the successful ones are able to continue to invest.
Right.
Now, if government assumes such a role, it won't face this kind of self-correcting competitive pressure. Right? Government can fail all day long.
And it's playing
millions after millions down the same drain.
And it's playing with our money, not their own.
Yes, it's playing with our money. This is playing with money that should be going to social grants, that should be going to roads, that should be going to policing. And there's absolutely nothing systematically that will put government under any pressure to turn these startups into successes. Other than maybe an internal target.
And haven't we already got a precursor to this and some kind of predictor of how this will go when we look at how the unions have invested union money into white monopoly capital, so to speak, and sometimes done very well, but for themselves as leaders of those trade unions, and sometimes done very poorly and lost their union members' money.
Yes, no, it's a risky thing to do.
Right.
Which is why it only should be done by private people with their own money,
right,
or with money that their owners at least put knowingly at risk.
Let's talk about the idea of buying local and protectionism in South Africa's economy versus the efficient allocation of public resources. And I'm quoting both of those from his speech. What do you make of that kind of language? Is it also forked tongue stuff?
It is. It's very strange, actually. I mean, do you remember when you were young? I mean, you're probably a bit younger than I am, but we were always told to koop Suid-Afrikaans.
Oh, was that the Nationalist Party?
Under the National Party. We were told and taught at school to buy local.
Mm-hmm.
No. I mean, obviously, the setting was a little bit different. National Party was coming under increasing sanctions, mm-hmm. so we had to kind of try and be self-sufficient. And you know, of course, as National Party, all gung ho, yeah, we'll be self-sufficient. We don't need your imports. Mm-hmm. Koop South Afrikaans.
Right.
Now, Ramaphosa promises the same sort of thing, right? But it's really nothing more than protectionism, because when local production is good enough, right, nobody needs to be told to buy local. Right? I buy lots of local groceries, right, because they're great. They're cheap. They fit my needs. Buying local when one would otherwise have bought foreign implies that you sacrifice either price or quality. So you sacrifice value. It artificially props up an uncompetitive local industry, which means that industry will never become competitive, forever become remain dependent on sort of tariffs and subsidies and preferential contracts. So, by definition, buy local protectionism raises prices and reduces quality.
Hmm.
Now, Ramaphosa then said that. He wants to efficiently allocate the resources of the state. Well, how do you do that if you deliberately raise prices and reduce quality of the things you buy?
Mm.
I mean, that contradicts. That's another contradiction.
Right. What you make of, first of all, Nomvula Mokonyane being retained in cabinet when she's made such a mess? She and Batabile Dlamini, it can be argued, have been among the worst public servants. We know what kind of a state she's left the Department of Water and Sanitation in. Yes. What exactly is this Digital Industrial Revolution Commission? I mean, some of that sounds, first of all, we're way past industrial. This is language from the 1920s in Europe. Digital is not a word that goes alongside industrial in the first place.
No.
Revolution is the last thing you want if you're the government in power, which they clearly don't understand when it comes to the purpose of the word. And any commission in this country seldom achieves anything. So what is Nomvula Mokonyane going to wave the magic wand and do with the Digital Industrial Revolution Commission? Or is this,
I don't know.
Is this just utter bullshit?
You should have been out on it, yeah. I mean, she dropped water and sanitation into a hole of debt. Like almost 5 billion rands worth of debt,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is bigger than Limpopo had when Limpopo was put under administration, Limpopo province.
Right.
So she left that department in a complete mess and entirely unable. I mean, Helen Zille likes to think it's about politics, but the national government was entirely unable, thanks to Mokonyane, to respond in any way to the drought crisis. Right. There's projects on the go, you know, right now that are sort of at the beginning stages, and the contractors have left because they haven't been paid for half a year.
Hmm.
So now she's going to be in charge of the Department of Communications, right? Yay.
Mm. Well, she can't do a worse job than Faith Mutambi. Let's just pause for a minute and take, you know, cognizance of that. I mean, you couldn't possibly try to do a worse job if you had a hammer and there were only nails around you. You couldn't
well,
do a worse
that's,
job.
That's true. That department has had a series of very unfortunate ministers over the years. You know, starting with back in the day with Ivy Matsepe Kasaburi,
mm-hmm.
whom I used to call Poison Ivy. you know, the question is: has the government ever shown itself to be capable of seizing the opportunities and managing the challenges of rapid advances in information and communication technology? Right? No, it hasn't. Not ever. Right? Back in the day when they thought people needed more connectivity, needed more phones, just after the democratic transition, they decided that cell phone licenses could be issued to the private sector because they were just toys for the rich. But landlines were the thing.
Yeah.
And therefore, Telkom needs to have a monopoly, and everyone needs to get a landline because, you know, too many people haven't had landlines because of apartheid.
And that went really well for Telkom and very poorly for Vodacom and Cell C and MTN.
Yeah, that went extremely well for the strategic investment. What were they called? Strategic investment partner of Telkom, right. An American company.
Mm-hmm.
But the number of lines declined. The number of lines in operation decline and keep declining. You know, there are fewer landlines now than there ever were because we don't need them.
Right.
And cell phones, right? We've got like something like 2 cell phones to every person in this country.
Right.
you know. And that's what the capitalists did with their supposed toy for the rich. The government just got that completely wrong, and it's one story after another just like that. So saying we're going to seize the opportunities is just empty talk. If you ask the private sector why South Africa's technology sector has not performed better in the last 20 years, right, every single one will tell you tales of government monopolies, of incompetence, of policy uncertainty, and overregulation. I'll eat my hat if anyone says, oh, if only we had a digital industrial revolution commission, we'd all be rich.
Yeah, I don't hear that kind of language. Let's talk about the national minimum wage. That's another thing you brought up in the Sona. What is this obsession with paying everybody a bare minimum? It's almost as if we regard ourselves as having succeeded if we can just reach a certain threshold and ordinary talented South Africans are at least paid a bare minimum. Is that better than nothing, or is it the most patronizing talk you've ever heard?
It's very patronizing. In fact, it's often got a counterproductive effect in that people who now earn above the minimum wage end up going down to minimum wage because companies say, well, you know, we don't have to pay you anymore. This is what the government says.
Right.
Right. So it sort of reduces their ability to negotiate their own wage higher. Minimum wage is not something that just magically raises the income of the lowest paid workers in society. Mm. A wage is a price for labor. Right? Now, a price, all prices, right, with the exception of some given goods and weird things, but all prices have a downward sloping demand curve. Right? Mm-hmm. That means that as the price rises, demand decreases, and vice versa. Right? This is how prices work. Now, there have been some revisionist papers on the topic which claim to show that miraculously higher minimum wages do not lead to lower employment. But the majority of economic research disagrees with those. And one of the reasons that is that one cannot test what employment levels would have been in the absence of a higher minimum wage.
Mm.
Now, so you can't count all the jobs that might have been created if wages were allowed to float lower.
So why do we hear so much noise in the mainstream media about how a minimum wage is a good thing because it guarantees people dignity in a certain occupation?
Living wage and
a
so on.
A living wage. Well, what is that all about?
If you think simplistically, Bastiat used to say that. He wrote about the things that are seen and the things that are not seen. The things that are seen is that a poor worker, a cashier or a cleaner, now gets more money, right? Which is great. They get to buy more stuff. They get to send their kids to school. They've got some more money to pay for healthcare. Mm-hmm. Lovely. But what the unseen effects, right, is what that does for unemployment in general. Right? Are you going to get millions of new jobs? No, you're actually going to get exactly the opposite, right? You're going to get fewer jobs. It makes it illegal for an unemployed person, right, to accept a job below the government stipulated wage rate.
Right. Right?
Even if they would prefer that low wage over unemployment, and the job would not be available at the minimum wage.
In other words, the corollary to this theory is that you are explicitly excluding some people from the economy because they don't
Correct.
Have the ability to reach that minimum wage level, and so they Yep. can't be employed at all.
Which, people who cannot add sufficient value to justify the minimum wage will remain unemployed.
And in this country, we already have an unemployment rate, which is somewhere around 27%. A lot of people are talking about how that's an insurmountable number for this government to try and erase. And of course, government can't create jobs. That's antithetical to what they exist for. Government pay out of the national treasury.
Government cannot be productive.
Right.
Government can only take other people's money to spend.
So let's
before we end on that one, without any irony, I noticed that Ramaphosa excluded domestic workers from the national minimum wage. Right? Because why? He feared unemployment. So domestic work, for some reason, obeys the price mechanism,
yeah,
but all other labor doesn't.
I didn't know that. Does that mean
there's a flat-out contradiction right there.
So hang on. Is it explicitly excluded?
Yes, from the national minimum wage. They'll have their own minimum wage, which is lower than the national minimum wage.
Because so often we're told that in examples that are given, that the minimum wage applies particularly to people like domestic workers who sometimes get paid way below what they should, and they sometimes have to do horrible work, and you know, they get considered as kind of servants. And this
what I mean is they get a lower minimum wage than everyone else.
That seems
so.
That
you talked
seems
about a national minimum wage. The domestics are excluded from that. They do have their own minimum wage, which is at a lower level.
That's incredible. I mean, it's almost like prejudice of a very specific kind.
Oh, no, that's because he fears unemployment in that sector.
All right, let's talk about employment for a second, because the one thing Cyril has done is he's retained this enormous unwieldy cabinet, and he's kept a lot of people in there that we have a problem with. Are there any good reasons to applaud this cabinet and the new appointments, and even bringing back of old people? Are there any reasons in your book for us to be excited or to be hopeful or to be optimistic with Cyril Ramaphosa's cabinet ministers?
Well, there are a few reasonable appointments. You know, Nene is not a bad appointment. He's proved himself to be a fairly competent finance minister. Gordon State and Enterprises is a pretty good call. I mean, if anyone can fix them, he can probably. I mean, he's one of those very rarities, you know, an honest communist.
Yeah.
You know, he's fundamentally a good guy. I mean, I love the way that he would go and sign Jacques Poe's book, you know, at book signings. You know, he's honest. He's not corrupt. He's completely opposed to the whole Gupta Zuma corruption nexus. But in general, look, you've got to remember that those people do remain socialists, and that is what that's the sort of thing they implement. You know, so from that perspective, no, you can't really be all that positive. And from the corruption and incompetence perspective, a number of ministers have been axed. You know, the people that he obviously couldn't keep on. But quite a few have been retained in Ramaphosa's cabinet. Most prominent among them is the deputy president, David Mabuza, right, who's been implicated in both corruption and political violence. You know, I mean, the guy is a thug.
Right.
Another is the lying Zuptoid Malusi Gigaba.
Yeah.
Right. We know he was captured. The capture of the state-owned institutions happened under his watch. And he lied about it under oath.
So, I mean, how much of what he spoke about at the budget last week matters if he was really a talking head whose head was going to roll the next week in respect of his finance position?
Well, I was astonished that he delivered the budget in the first place. His delivery, incidentally, was awesome.
Yeah, it pulls the carpet out from under Treasury in some ways, because there was this guy parading, and I wrote a thing about how he was a pretend finance minister, but it turned out that's exactly what he was.
Yeah, well, now Nene takes over, and he has basically has to deal with the budget that was written for him by Malusi Gigaba and the ANC.
Mm.
So he gets absolutely no freedom, and certainly not in his first year as finance minister.
So you can understand then why he was less than excited to take the job.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, I would be too.
Yeah.
You're going to put me in a job, and the first thing I want to do, you know, it's like starting as manager of a football team. First job you want is to be able to hire and fire some players so you can actually get a team together that you think can win.
Explain to me as simply as you can, and you have a way of kind of cutting to the core of an issue without having to be distracted by externalities. Explain to me why this expropriation without compensation bill is bad and how it was necessary in a country where expropriation has been an available implementation of policy by government for, what, 22 years? It's been something they could use and didn't very often use. Why was this necessary, and what's it really about?
Well, that to me was the real bombshell of the last week or two. And I think it's appropriate that we discuss it on a show called The Burning Platform. Yeah. It now appears to me that spinning off the EFF to raise this issue, only to adopt it back into the ANC's platform once the shouting was over, I think was the strategy all along. It perfectly chimes with the socialist policies of the ANC and the National Democratic Revolution, which was written by the Communist Party and remains the ANC's sort of central ideology document, where they want to hold land in the hands of the state, right? And then government decides how best it is used. All right, so you get to lease your land. Right, and it can lead to all sorts of weird things. I mean, the government can basically decide what you can and can't do on your land. Now, they appear to want to start with farmland and they believe that the redistribution process to date has not been successful, which is true, it hasn't, partially because a lot of the claims haven't actually been processed. And a lot of the claims that have been processed, I think I read some statistics from the Institute for Race Relations the other day. They said of the claims that have been processed and farms that have been expropriated and given to new farmers, about 70 to 80% fail to create a marketable surplus. Right. So only 25-odd% of those farms actually continue to work. So we have a problem that they feel that there hasn't enough has happened under the regime of expropriation with compensation.
Mm.
Right. So now they're going to go with expropriation without compensation.
And how will that change things from the point of view of government?
Well, for a start, they'll have to gut the property clause, right? And that has incredibly wide implications, because once you can expropriate land without compensation, you can expropriate any property without compensation.
So that means technically that they could take your car or your pen, or they could come around and steal your chickens.
Yeah, they could take your house, they could take your car. No property is safe. They could take your investments. If they believe that you've made too much money in a company, they could take half of your windfall. You know, they could confiscate everything. If they ran out of money, they could raid your pension fund, your private pension fund,
mm-hmm.
Because it's a national emergency. Who wouldn't want to help South Africa, you know, remain out of a hole? So we're going to confiscate 20% of all pension funds.
But they're talking. I mean,
all of that becomes
Ivo,
possible.
That sounds hugely alarmist to some people, because we've heard mutterings in the last couple of days of much more moderate takes on this, from even Julius Malema saying, no, we're not going to take anyone off their land or chase them away. Somehow we're magically just going to make land out of nothing. Or worse still, I heard that, food security is a big issue to government, and they will prioritize things like food security despite having to try and enact this. What do you make of that? Is it again doublespeak?
It is doublespeak. You know, of course they're not going to say that. Look, you know, they're going to do all of this, at once, and they won't. I mean, this will be a gradual process. Malema wants all land, including industrial, commercial, and residential land, to be in the hands of government. He believes that government can somehow decide whether land is optimally used, which of course government can't, because it has no way to know that. But that's how he wants the whole.
Are you saying this because you know his mind, or because you've read the EFF's manifesto?
No, that's what he actually said the other day.
Yeah,
a few days ago, he said, nobody will lose their house, or their shop, or whatever, but the land will belong to the government.
So we'll all rent from the government.
We'll all lease from the government. Correct. At the government's pleasure. So as soon as the government doesn't like what we're doing on that land, then they just cancel our lease.
Hmm.
Easy enough. Now Ramaphosa then said that we are determined that expropriation without compensation should be implemented in a way that increases agricultural production and improves food security. That is exactly what Hugo Chavez said in Venezuela in 2010. No, just a few years ago.
Huh.
And almost immediately, food imports began to rise. And today, the country is quite literally starving. Right? Everything that has been nationalized has been destroyed, right? Leaving behind a ruined economy and hyperinflation with the rising civilian death toll. You can say whatever you like. All your good intentions can be good. You know, we're going to do this in such a way. But what if it can't be done in a way that improves food security? I mean, a well-connected source tells me that the government believes it only really needs the largest 20% of farms to produce food, right? Which leaves 80% of small and medium-sized farms to be subdivided into small holdings and given to the peasants.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, this will totally destroy rural and small-town economies. I mean, half of the food I buy from small and local farms in the area, and not because I go out and I'm one of these greenies that believes in buying local.
Well, you are a bit of an environmental activist, I must say.
yes, I am, in a manner of speaking. But I go to my supermarket, and these brands are there in the supermarket, and they are cheaper,
yeah,
you know, than anything else. Stuff imported from I don't know, from other provinces or something. So the small and medium sized farms have a huge role to play in food security, especially at a local level. So if you do this, if you destroy all of those, turn them into small holdings, it's going to entirely destroy the rural and small town economies. You know, I just said that only about 25% of redistributed farmland continue to produce marketable surpluses. So this is going to cause a massive decline in the supply of fresh foods, which will cause sharp food price increases.
Right.
And that's how it starts.
So you're just saying that there's the realistic market, and then there's this idea that politicians have that they can adjust it and they can make it different.
Yes, that they can fiddle with things, and they can expropriate large swathes of land with no consequences, or in fact the opposite of what the likely consequences will be. It's magic thinking. It's just dreams.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, you've raised a lot of things that I suppose some people are not comfortable with dealing with, and some people don't have answers for yet, and probably the president doesn't have answers for.
Before I go, I want to leave you with one more thought.
Yeah.
How do you think thousands of farmers with plenty guns and nothing left to lose are likely to respond?
Yeah, this is the threat of violence that a lot of people have mentioned.
Exactly. They could be nice and just hand over the keys, but somehow I don't think that'll happen. Right? They'll argue that they have a basic right to defend their property by force of arms if the state won't do it for them. Now, I mean, it's the Constitution prohibits us from actually discussing whether we think that that argument is justified, because we are not allowed to advocate for war.
Mm-hmm.
But there it is. I mean, that's how they're going to think. A farmer with nothing to lose and lots of guns, how's he going to respond?
You could also argue that someone who's got nothing and has nothing to lose either in terms of their position in the economy might be willing to do things too that lead to violence.
True. So I can see bloodshed happening on both sides of that particular equation.
If it's not managed extremely carefully by people who are very sensitive to issues on both sides.
Yeah, indeed.
All right, well, Ivo, it's...
And I fear it won't be.
It's always good to catch up, and thank you for standing in this morning. We'll continue to see what you're up to in the various publications you write for, and appreciate you being part of the Burning Platform today.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Ivo Fechter, and the Burning Platform brought to you by Nando's.
This is CliffCentral.com.